This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, May 2nd, 2011. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Baby Literary Monsters. A few weeks ago, our website poetryfoundation.org published an interview with the poet Bernadette Mayer. Now in her 60s, Bernadette Mayer came out of New York's downtown poetry scene of the 60s and 70s. Nowadays, her work is championed by a lot of younger poets who see in Mayer a dazzling model for experimental language, for humor, and for just plain fun. The interview up on our website was written by Adam Fitzgerald, a poet living in the East Village and the editor of the literary magazine Maggie. Now, Adam, I don't actually normally like written interviews with writers or poets. I usually find them really snoozy. But your interview with Mayer was a lot of fun. And she comes across as quite a character, quite an interesting character with an incredible past. For this program, though, rather than focus on her life, I thought we would play two poems. But first, I want to ask you, what did you think when you first encountered Bernadette Mayer's work? Why do you like it so much?
When you listen to Bernadette Mayer's work, you hear a voice speaking in poetry that you've never heard before.
Uh-huh.
And though there are many great female poets, you know, Sappho, Dickinson, Rossetti, Anne Carson, there's a Living Dead, there is something about the rawness of Mayer's voice that has the amazing ability to put together contradictory elements of what you expect to find in poetry. I mean, she's, when I say raw, and yet she's obsessed with translating and retranslating Catullus.
Yes.
You know, and so, and yet, of course,
Catullus, the great Latin poet, it's very unusual to have somebody from the New York school scene very, very interested in Catullus.
Right. And yet, the funny thing is, if you go back to Catullus and reread, and this is maybe what the whole relay torch system of literature is about, you realize that Catullus was kind of the New York school member of the old Latin poets. I mean, you know, he was kind of urbane, witty, sophisticated, writing poems to his friends and kind of having a good laugh.
Yeah.
You know, impeccable poet, but raunchy as hell.
Yeah. And Bernadette Mayer is a bit raunchy too.
Absolutely.
As we'll hear in the first poem we're going to listen to, which is a poem from the late 1960s. And it feels like it could have been written yesterday, frankly, because its critique holds today. And it's called simply Sonnet.
You jerk, you didn't call me up. I haven't seen you in so long, you probably have a fucking tan. And besides that, instead of making love tonight, you're drinking your parents to the airport. I'm through with you bourgeois boys. All you ever do is go back to ancestral comforts only money can get. Even Catullus was rich, but nowadays you guys settle for a couch by a soporific colored cable TV set instead of any arc of love. No wonder the G.I. Joe team blows it every other time. Wake up, it's the middle of the night. You can either make love or die at the hands of the Cobra Commander. To make love, turn to page 32. To die, turn to page 110.
Now, this is such a funny poem because it's such a direct challenge to begin a poem saying, you jerk, you didn't call me up, and then to say, I'm here ready to make love to you, but you'd rather be watching your color TV.
Yeah.
But the tone of it is direct. It's insulting. It has a lot of life and colloquial life in it. Does that come directly out of Catullus?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, Catullus's most famous line that most people might know, even if they don't know that it's from him, is, you know, I'm paraphrasing a translation of it. It's an epigram. It's two lines, you know, I love and I hate. You ask me how it is that I can do both, but it, you know, that's just the way it is. That ability to mix emotions in the lyric, to both hate the person you're addressing and to love them at the same time, I think it's probably as old as poetry or love is itself, you know. And Catullus in his day would kind of curse, and I don't know any of the good old Latin swears, but I know Bernadette does very well, actually.
Yeah, she says, you probably have a fucking tan. And besides that, instead of making love tonight, you're drinking your parents to the airport. That's a brilliant formulation. You're drinking your parents to the airport, not driving them.
Yeah. Well, it's great because you hear you're drinking and driving and you have to take your parents to the airport.
Yeah.
And it all gets condensed down to the most insulting and kind of bizarre verb choice in the new syntactical construction. You're drinking your pass to the airport, so it's great.
Yeah. And then I'm through with you bourgeois boys. And what I can't help but feeling like she's talking to me in some way or another. I'm a bourgeois boy myself, you know?
Yeah, but at least she's talking to us.
Yeah, in an insulting way. But this is what's striking about a lot of her poetry for me. It offers a very strong feminist critique, but it's also extremely attractive. At the
Absolutely.
Same time, she's saying, fuck you. You guys would rather watch TV and drive your parents to the airport than come make love to me. So it's a come hither expression at the same time as being very tough on the person she's speaking to.
I mean, what's not to love? I mean, the tone of her work, the wryness and the dryness and the fact that it's ribald and assured and very cerebral and muscular at the same time, she is able to sound ironic without being cutesy. She's able to be vulgar without seeming easy. Mm. She's able to be formal without being stiff.
Yeah.
And so she has this edge and fault line in all of her work, especially in a poem like this, that she's able to write it in such a way that the reader never gets, and maybe we don't want to get, a kind of ease or comfort of saying, oh, this is her stance, or this is her feeling ultimately is this.
Right.
There's a kind of wryness to it that you don't really know to what, how serious are the serious parts, how non-serious are the non-serious parts. You kind of have to take it in its simultaneity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that makes her kind of why she's such a great poet.
Let's listen to another poem. This is one that you chose. It's called Eve of Easter. Tell us about this poem. Set it up for us a little bit before we hear. It's a little bit more complex, quite a bit longer than the sonnet we just heard.
Sure. This poem is Mayer, or the Bernadette Mayer that gets at least dramatized and poeticized in her work, is sitting down one evening and having to take care of her friend's children. And she's doing this while she's thinking about the lives of these illustrious authors, Milton, Melville, and Hawthorne, who she loves.
Yeah, let's listen to it. This is called Eve of Easter.
Milton, who made his illiterate daughters read to him in five languages till they heard the news he would marry again and said they would rather hear he was dead. Milton, who turns even Paradise Lost into an autobiography. I have three babies tonight. All three are sleeping. Rachel, the great-great-great-granddaughter of Herman Melville, is asleep on the bed. Sophia and Marie are sleeping. Sophia, namesake of the wives of Louis Friedson, the scholar, and Nathaniel Hawthorne. Marie, my mother's oldest name, these three girls resting in the dark. I made the lucent dark. I stole images from Milton to cure opacous gloom, to render the room an orb beneath this raucous moon of March, eclipsed only in daylight, heavy breathing baby bodies, daughters and descendants in the presence of the great ones, Milton and Melville and Hawthorne, everyone is speaking at once. I only looked at them, all blended, each half Semitic, of a race always at war. The rest of their inherited grace from among Nordics, Germans and English, writers at peace, rushing, warring Jews into democracy, when actually peace is at the window begging entrance with the hordes in the midst of air, too cold for this time of year. Eve of Easter and the shocking resurrection idea. Some one baby stirs now, hungry for an egg. It's the Melville baby going to make a fuss. The Melville one sucking her fingers for solace. She makes a squealing noise. Hawthorne baby still deeply asleep. The one like my mother's out like a light. The Melville one, though, the smallest, wants the most because she doesn't really live here. Hawthorne will want to be nursed when she gets up. Melville sucked a bit and dozed back off. Now Hawthorne is moving around. She's the most hungry, yet perhaps the most seduced by darkness in the room. I can hear Hawthorne. I know she's awake now. But will she stir, disturbing the placid sleep of Melville and insisting on waking us all? Meanwhile, the rest of the people in Lenox drive up and down the street. Now Hawthorne wants to eat. They all see the light by which I write. Hawthorne sighs. The house is quiet. I hear Melville's toy. I've never changed the diaper of a boy. I think I'll go get Hawthorne and nurse her for the pleasure of cutting through darkness before her measured noise stimulates the boys. I'll cook a fish, retain poise in the presence of heady descendants, stone-willed their fathers look at me and drink ink. I return a look to all the daughters and I wink. Eve of Easter, I've inherited this peaceful sleep of the children of men. Rachel, Sophia, Marie, and again me. Bernadette, all heart I live, all head, all eye, all ear. I lost the prejudice of paradise and wound up caring for the babies of these guys.
That was Eve of Easter from Bernadette Maris' The Golden Book of Words, published in 1978. It was recorded by Pacifica Radio in 1979 and is available on the great online poetry archive Penn Sound.
Let me add, there's also a beautiful clip of her reading it on YouTube. And so if people interested.
Yeah, when she takes a swig of a beer and then starts...
chain smokes away.
Yes, it's wonderful. So the poem starts with a feminist critique of Milton, blind Milton, and the way the crappy way he treated his daughters. Mm. And then cuts to the children she's taking care of.
I have three babies tonight. All three are sleeping. Rachel, the great-great-great-granddaughter of Herman Melville, is asleep on the bed. Sophia and Marie are sleeping. Sophia, namesake of the wives of Louis Friedson, the scholar, and Nathaniel Hawthorne. Marie, my mother's oldest
name. As the poem goes on, a kind of radical synecdoche kind of goes awry, and the children start being represented with the authors, and then before it's over, the children are the authors. And I asked her this at one point in the interview. I said, you know, before the poem's over, you've wonderfully just re-transgendered the rest of the white male tradition.
I can hear Hawthorne. I know she's awake now. But will she stir, disturbing the placid sleep of Melville and insisting on waking us all? Meanwhile, the rest...
What I think the poem manages to do is create a kind of declaration of independence for Mare as a poet. She is stealing and looting from the great tradition. But it's nothing as easy as saying, you know, all those old white dead males are horrible and we kind of have to be done with the old and in with the new. Because if you hear the poem, Lucent Dark, Orb, Raucous Room, she's taken actual phrases and lines from Milton. And I know from reading her other work and, you know, just the diction and cadence of her lines, she is a deep devotee of Hawthorne and Melville, and even of Milton. And so I think what she manages to do is she's kind of, people use the word queering as a verb. I don't know if you could say the poem necessarily feminizes the English male tradition of poetry, but it does something like that. There is some kind of distortion that is meant to be both, I think, a corrective. I think it's meant to be humorous.
Yeah, that's the key thing. I think she's really funny. It really
is
funny.
Absolutely.
I mean, to take these guys and talk and turn them into babies and then refer to them as Hawthorne and Melville. Melville needs a breast.
Absolutely.
It's just really,
you know, and they're
funny.
At her feet suddenly. You know, and that's what I think so great about the poem. It's a total reversal. Mm. You know, it starts off with here she's Bernadette Mayer, having to, you know, be this kind of domestic woman taking care of people's children. She's a babysitter.
Yeah.
And before the poem's over, three of the greatest writers you could imagine are kind of depending upon her. They need her.
But there's also a sense of great affection for the children themselves, which, in other words, I'm not sacrificing the delights of having children for the great literary tradition. She's going to have both. She's going to have her cake and eat it too.
Just speaking to Bernadette in the interview, one of the things that I thought was so funny, I remember asking her very frankly, I said, well, you know, Bernadette, back in the 60s, a lot of women kind of felt the pressure to go get married and have children. And some of them have even written about that meant they didn't have the same advantages as male writers who could kind of not have to take care of young children and kind of keep producing work. And I said, did it ever occur to you that maybe you shouldn't have children? And she immediately laughed in her kind of great cackle and just said, you know, yeah, a lot of men always would try to tell me that. You know, she's like, and she said, I loved having children. I would have gone on having children if I could have. Uh-huh. You know, there's nothing for me better than that.
Thanks so much, Adam.
Thank you, Curtis.
You can read Adam Fitzgerald's interview with Bernadette Mayer on our newly redesigned website, poetryfoundation.org, where you can also read a generous number of Bernadette Mayer poems. Do let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.